Hello and welcome to the Freightvine podcast, your source for all things freight transportation. I'm Chris Kaplis, Chief Scientist at DAT Freight and Analytics, and today I'm joined by Ann Reinke, President and CEO of the Transportation Intermediaries Association, or TIA. As most of you listening to this podcast already know, TIA serves more than 1,700 3PLs, providing leadership, direction, and education to help them better manage their companies for growth and profitability. Ann took over the reins at TIA during the middle of the pandemic, something that we'll discuss during our conversation. And prior to joining TIA, Ann held various senior roles with the Federal Department of Transportation, as well as the Class 1 Railroad CSX. In our conversation, we'll talk about what TIA does, how the intermediary industry is changing, and what it's like to take over and lead an organization in the pandemic, as well as in a post-pandemic world. Okay, following my conversation with Ann, I'll be joined by Dr. Enam Ayoub to discuss the truckload market update. So let's get started. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the Freightvine podcast.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So you are the CEO and president of the TIA, the Transportation Intermediaries Association. So let's just dive into that.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about, give us an overview of what the TIA does and who it serves. Just give us some background.
Great. So the TIA, Transportation Intermediaries Association, is the voice of the third-party logistics industry. And we represent about 1,600 members of all sizes. They could be small, you know, less than $1 million annual revenue, one or two person shops, to greater than $500 million in revenue, you know, multi-scaled companies that are on NASDAQ or on the New York Stock Exchange. So because we have such a differing number of kinds of members based on revenue categories, we also serve multiple purposes. For the smaller members, really what they're looking for is best practices and education. So we have an education and training component. We have classes that people can learn. It's called a new broker success program for those who are new entrants into the marketplace. And then for those who have been around a while, we have certification courses for those called the Certified Transportation Broker course. Those we find really appeal to the smaller to mid-sized members. For our larger members, we have advocacy in Washington, you know, in front of Congress, in front of the various agencies. You know, traditionally, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration is the agency we go to most, just because most of our members are truck facing, though we do have railroad facing and ocean carrier facing interests as well. You know, essentially, we are bridging the gap between the shipper and the carrier and trying to make the whole transaction the safest, most efficient, and most ethical that we can. I would say all of our members are interested in the networking opportunities. So, you know, in a pandemic, those have been limited. But traditionally, pre-pandemic, and we hope post-pandemic when we're all vaccinated and doing a lot better, we will have those in-person networking events where people are actually developing best practices and relationships where they figure out, okay, here's a problem. How can I, do you have a technological solution that you use? How can I, you know, work on this? So that's really what I think that the industry and the association does best.
Okay. Yeah, so you mentioned multiple modes, and that the dominant mode is truck facing.
Right.
I imagine it's mainly full truckload brokerage.
That's right.
But you have some other modes in there, and so I would imagine as you face the government, it's not just one entity that you're facing, one agency, right? Because the government's very much modally divided. Do you find you have yourself have to, I don't want to use the L word, to lobby across those different modes?
Yeah. So
how do you treat that?
Right. So our government affairs operation, they work well with USDOT. Now, as you may know, I just came from USDOT. So technically, I cannot speak to them because I must honor my ethics pledge. So I cannot for another year or so. But yes, we work with Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration most closely. But we also have to have some interface with, as you mentioned, the Federal Railroad Administration, with MARAD, and then outside of USDOT, the Federal Maritime Commission. And so our VP of Government Affairs, Chris Burrows, maintains those relationships because you never know when our members have an interest or an issue that will impact them. And then we have to go to that modal agency. And as they say about lobbying, I'm a former lobbyist. You want to build that relationship before you need it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you've been on all sides, and we'll get onto that in just a few minutes. Right. So where are you spending most of your time now? Because you've been in the position for about 7 months. We'll talk about taking over an organization during a pandemic, because that's a whole
topic.
Where are you focusing your time?
Sure. So when I started, you know, I've been in the transportation space for my entire career, other than I'm a lapsed lawyer, but I've been in the transportation space my entire career. So I know a lot about transportation, but I had less visibility into the brokerage space. So what I really wanted to do externally facing was listening and learning and understanding exactly what our members' businesses look like, what they're most concerned about, what they've been focusing on. And then obviously internally facing too, what has the culture must suffer when we're not all together. That's just an aspect of, you know, the pandemic, but how do we empower our staff? Has our staff felt like they've had visibility? Do they feel like they've had, you know, exposure to our members, et cetera, et cetera? So that's really what I've been spending my time on. Now I feel like there was some low hanging fruit that I was working on, that we had some you know, processes that we needed to change and put some things in place. So now, as I say, I'm in the medium hanging fruit, and the medium hanging fruit, I think, only becomes evident to one as you fan out and actually go to members, you know, sites, their headquarters. And so that's what I've been working on with vaccines, fortunately, and more members bringing their teams back to work in person. I've been able to take advantage of that. And I've done 2 member visits, planning a third. That's something that I want to do. And eventually I'll get on an airplane and I will fly and see members as well.
One of these days. That's interesting. I've talked to a bunch of carriers and shippers, and especially for the carriers, you know, they have the guys who are doing the sales, and they're usually at shippers on the road all the time. They found that they were able to visit more companies, especially existing clients, in a day using Zoom than they could in a week normally traveling.
Yes.
So do you think, what's interesting, do you think that the relationship is going to change? Do you think the need to glad hand or face-to-face is going to be there as much as if we could meet over Zoom or Teams or some other remote method?
Well, so as you know, there's benefits to Zoom for sure. Yeah. I mean, I've been able to meet members in California and Utah and Chicago that would take me days to get to. And I think pre-pandemic, was there a lot of travel that was likely unnecessary? Sure. Have I been on travel that was unnecessary?
Sure.
Absolutely. However, I just don't think you can replicate the kind of organic nature of what happens when people are together. And so, Zoom is a good facsimile of that, but I don't think it's necessarily everything. And so I do think, like, even with these visits that I have had so far, yes, I've actually Zoomed with a couple of them, but there was something different about things that occur to them because they're at their workplace, or things that I see that they probably wouldn't have thought to mention. It's just a little bit more, I think, of a fulfilling opportunity.
Yeah. And the other thing is that when you're in a meeting, you have side conversations.
Right.
And you can see things. And the thing that I find very frustrating for Zoom or any kind of thing is everything is structured and formal. Right. And so I can't talk to an individual easily. I can chat and do all that. But it seems like the serendipity, the things you don't expect, you just can't get those as much. I agree.
Yeah. And you always feel like you have the narrator on Zoom, and then you have like the Greek chorus. So it can get tiring.
But it raises the flip side. So the last thing that a lot of people here at MIT, we look around and talk to our people who usually work here. And we used to be 100% in the office 100% of the time. And now, you know, we've been remote the whole time. And the question is, we want to come back a little bit, but not all. But the main point is, if you come back, we don't want to have people come back, sit in their cube and answer emails. I mean, that's a waste of time. So how do you think companies need to make it so that when you're in the office, you're doing something worth being in the office for? Do you think that's going to change the nature of work in your area?
I do. I think so. So a couple things. First, our chief administrative officer, Polly Bond, has put together a team. It's called the Safe Return to Work Team. And we've asked our employees to join that team just for their input and to get their perspectives. Because what I may think is different, perhaps, than someone else who has been here for 5 years or 10 years or what have you.
Right,
so how
right.
can we coalesce around that? And to your point, yeah, let's not get back to work just for the hell of it. Let's get back to work in a way that makes sense. I agree with you that I think it will likely never be the same as it was, because I think before there was a cheeks and seats mentality that may or may not have been, you know, merited. But I do think there are in my experience, there are misunderstandings that can occur over email that are much more easily fixed if you go down the hall and talk to someone. I think it's harder to build a culture of trust and support and transparency virtually than there is in person. And so where we end up, I think, is let's have an opportunity for people to come together when they have meetings that cross silos, for example, so that they actually right. can have, to your point, the side conversations, the organic things that come up. To me, that's where the utility is, where you can actually meet with people that you don't typically talk to all the time.
Yeah. It's funny talking about the, you know, committees to see how you return to work and everything. I'm finding that people here at MIT, a lot of times we're asking the wrong question. We're asking, what would you like it to be, rather than what should it be to better achieve your mission? Right. And so it's a slight different challenge, because there are some things you can do better working from home. You have more concentration, less disturbance. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it mixes. And I like your comment about people just, instead of an email, going down the hall. I'm finding that it's very generational. I don't know if you feel this way. A lot of people, you know, whether they're millennials or somewhere in there, they prefer to email to phone. And they prefer a phone to in person. It's like almost they'd rather stay away from them. The older people are, they more attuned to the face to face. Have you noticed that, or is that just me?
Yes, So first of all, I'm a proud Gen Xer. I feel like we're the forgotten generation. After every single president in the last few have been baby boomers, like no one even thinks about us anymore. But anyway, that aside, yeah.
Your day will come.
Our day will come. I absolutely agree with you. I do think the younger generation is just so much more comfortable with technology anyway. And from my understanding, I don't know, but they sometimes think it's rude to call someone and intrude on their time. As opposed to me, who would just pick up the phone and say, this is so much easier than interacting 17 emails later. Like, we could have resolved it in 10 minutes.
Right, right, right. No, I agree. So let's focus in a little bit about taking an organization over during a pandemic. What was it like? Because you've run other organizations before, but now you're coming in and this is a new area for you. It's still transportation, but the intermediaries and a new organization. How did you handle that?
Well, there was a lot of Zooming. Blocks of Zooming. And here are a couple things that were kind of immediate issues of concern. One is, as I mentioned, we are known for our networking events. And in fact, one in particular, our annual conference, and it's typically in April. And so we had to make a threshold decision. All right, next year, so I started in October. Next year, are we going to have our meeting in person? And we tried to have it come in person, and you know, maybe we could have made it succeed, but it was April, May timeframe. We've decided now to be May 11th through the 13th virtually. But it just wouldn't have, we probably couldn't have garnered the in-person attendance. And then at that point, you're just spending money really not for any real good purpose. So that was kind of one of the biggest challenges to sink our teeth into. What I really noticed is I had to rely on the team, because the team has been in place by and large. There are a few who've come over the last year, but by and large, there's a team that's been in place here for 9 or 10 years who know the members, who know the issues. Not only do they know the members, they like the members. They want to do right by the members. And so I had to learn from them and really lean on them to kind of educate me as to, okay, here's where there are some fires that we need to put out. Here are the people, you know, the top 15 people that you need to talk to. And I will mention the executive committee and the hiring committee who hired me as part of the board were enormously helpful to me, because they also said, here's what I think the members are calling for, and here's why you need to talk to them. And so that really gave me a profoundly good direction. So yes, it was all remote, and it was, you know, challenging to interact with everyone. But in a way, I could cut through to your earlier point about visiting everybody and taking a lot of time to do so. I could actually connect with a bunch of different people in a short period of time.
Yeah, I know the taking over an organization or a new role, the first 100 days is critical for that. Right. It's mainly that communications. So did you find your management or leadership style had to change by being remote all the time? Or were you more of a hands-on face-to-face manager before, and did you have to change things? How did that adjust?
Well, I think, you know, all things being equal, I would love it to be the walking around manager, which that I used to be. And I think that's the kind of manager where you kind of pick up things that you didn't really know. But so I can't be a walking around manager. But what hasn't changed is that I am a collaborative leader and one who is compelled by humility more than anything else. That's a core value. And there's a book, I'm sure you've read it, called Humble Leadership. And it really struck me because it's exactly the kind of leader that I think I am, that I want to model my team to be, which is, I'm not the hero here. I'm not the one who has all the answers. Yeah, I'm the final decider, but I want to hear everyone's perspectives and understand their experiences, because they all have something to contribute that I probably don't know. And so that to me has been, I guess, something that the pandemic actually made into sharper relief, because I probably could have just started traveling right away and not benefited from hearing from them. I could have just said, well, I'm going to go out and visit all these members and hear from them. But having the time to actually listen to them helped.
No, that makes sense. Let me go back to something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned you have a wide range of size of members, very small to very large. And the small ones, you focused on the education. And I'm curious if the delivery of education, do you think, is going to change? Because during the pandemic, everything is being done remote. And we're finding we can actually teach some things pretty well remotely versus in person. Was the education predominantly before this done in person, or was it done remote? Or do you see that changing because of the pandemic?
Well, so I mentioned that we have this annual meeting. Last year, we canceled it. The 2021 was canceled. And so what they did was they turned what would have been sessions at the conference into lunch and learn.
2020 was canceled, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. So the 2020 conference sessions we would have had turned into essentially 2-day-a-week educational courses.
Interesting.
Delivered virtually. We had always had what we called VILT, virtual instruction-led training, just because our members are so far flung. But we also had an in-person component. And one thing that we beta tested and we're going to redo, we're going to sort of, you know, reinvent, is what we called our Leadership Academy. Our Leadership Academy was going to be predominantly in person. And if you think about it, the analogous example would be an executive MBA, where people who are participants once a month get all together, and they sort of, not only are they learning, but they're engaging each other and they're developing these relationships over time that will benefit them and their businesses. So Leadership Academy had to then go complete virtually. But as we bring it back, there will be an in-person component, because how do you develop those relationships? It's virtually, well, I won't say it's impossible.
It's
challenging to do it online with people you don't know.
I think that's the key point. And if seeing, especially like turning on the videos, a lot of times companies will have the culture that cameras are always on, or once you know the people, you don't have to have your cameras on, because there's a little bit of a tax. If you have a call to China at 7 a.m, do you want to be, you know, put your makeup on and all that kind of stuff? But let me ask about remote, because there's different kinds of remote. And I did this at MIT. I created all these online MicroMaster courses in supply chain management. And there's synchronous and there's asynchronous. And so synchronous is what we're doing right now. We see each other, but we're all remote. And I could do this with multiple people versus asynchronous, which is like a pre-recorded video. And what we've found up at MIT and other places is that they each have a role. And sometimes an asynchronous video is the best way to get a concept, because then the person learning can go back and go forward, can go at their own pace, as opposed to sitting in a classroom where they're a little nervous about saying they don't quite understand something. Do you see yourself using a mix of those things as well?
Yeah, our team currently does, to your point, too, because, you know, a lot of people who are getting this education are not full-time students.
Right.
So they have to fit it in where they can fit it in. And maybe it's easier for them at the end of the workday to watch a video and listen to the lesson than it is to fit it in, you know, at 12 p.m. or lunchtime. It all depends on what their schedule is. So, yeah, and a great example of that is with our new broker success education course, we have the asynchronous parts of the video and the training and that kind of thing. But now we've also have a synchronous part where we have coaching that is available. We have a few people who are new coaches to us who have been in the industry and have great thoughts and are really excited about developing the newest sort of generation of brokers and how to make them successful. So that's a great example of how we do both.
Yeah. You know what is interesting? Being able to communicate synchronously online is another skill that needs to be done, because it's not going away. And so maybe that's just another skill that needs to be developed for people, because it's not just networking in person. We have to learn how to also network and be able to operate in a remote situation as well. So it'll
be a mix. I mean, you have to be engaging. You can't, in a sense, it's almost easier to deliver a course in person, because you can kind of go and do a PowerPoint presentation. And everyone takes notes, but it's a lot harder to be that engaging. And I mean, I feel for the teachers who are doing this, because it's a lot more challenging to be engaging. You can't just revert to a PowerPoint presentation and expect people to listen. So yeah, you're right. We're all learning new skill sets.
Yeah, especially if you're teaching like K through 12. I actually saw someone in an airport, a little three-year-old was having her class. And oh my God, I felt for the teacher, because the kids would pop in and out. And I teach at the graduate level, and that's hard enough.
That's hard enough. I have a five-year-old and a 12-year-old. And let me tell you, a five-year-old can't learn online. It just doesn't work. So anyway.
Let's flip and talk about the space. So especially most of the people listening to this are shippers or carriers or brokers. And so we all know that over the last 5 to 10 years, the brokerage space for truckload has really changed. There's been a lot of infusion of VC money. And so you had the Uber for Freights, the Convoys, the Transfix, and a bunch of other ones. How have you seen the that new digital freight broking their brokerages coming in? Has that changed the market, or are they just intermediaries, brokers by another name?
Right. I don't think it's changed the marketplace necessarily. Is there something that our members get concerned about, the digitalization of freight? Absolutely. There's concern, but from my perspective, these guys are doing the same job using technology that all of our members are using, which is they're basically trying to find efficiencies in the marketplace between the shipper and the carrier. They're aggregating capacity because of relationships that they have with tens of thousands of carriers and thousands of shippers. And so perhaps they're using different technological means to do so. But the interest that they have, whether it be for advocacy or litigation or liability or what have you, are identical. So, you know, technology is sort of like the bugaboo. You know, we love it and we fear it at the same time. We love it because it does make our lives easier. We fear it because we don't know what it will do in the future.
Right.
Yeah, I think, quite frankly, it makes all of our members more competitive, because as they see a new entrant into the marketplace doing something different, they think, okay, well what should I do differently? I have found of our membership is they are enormously entrepreneurial. And so if they have a challenge that they can't figure out, they will bend over backwards to try to figure it out, whether it's employing a new technological mix, or whether it's using a vendor that they hadn't used before, or acquiring another company that does something different in a space that they don't have, you know, visibility into. Whatever it is, I think that they are open to all of it.
I agree with you. I think that, and I draw a parallel to what Lyft and Uber did to the cab business. I'm in Boston, and prior to Uber and Lyft, cabs, the credit card machine never worked. They were dirty. They were really just a pain. But once Uber and Lyft came in, it's like, oh, we got to raise our game.
Right.
So it seems like the whole level has gotten better. And the other thing is, when I talk to a lot of brokers, traditional brokers, they talk about the amount of money they put into R&D. And it many times it dwarfs what a lot of the more publicized digital brokers do. So you're exactly right. Everyone's adding technology. It's just some have, it seems, bigger marketing budgets to proclaim what they're doing.
Yeah. And I think regardless of technology, the cornerstone of this business anyway is relationships. That hasn't changed and that will never change. And so, yes, we have to invest in technology. We have to, because it'll make actually doing business with us easier. So that's great for the future, right? We want more people to do business with us, but we're always going to have to fall back on those relationships, which at the beginning, at the outset, I said we have to be safe, ethical, and efficient. And that's what our relationship is. No one's going to come back to our members if we aren't those three things.
Yeah. You know, let's dive into relationships, because I agree with you that it's still a relationship business. But over the last 25, 30 years, I've been involved in it in different areas. The type of relationships have changed. It's no longer, from what I've seen, more give me tickets, take me to dinner, let's go to the Masters. I mean, that's there, but not as much. It seems the relationship is no longer, hey, I'm your buddy, give me your business. It's more, let me help you solve your problem.
Right.
Have you noticed that too? It seems like a more focused on the job, and I don't know why that's happened.
Yeah, again, I'll go back to Gen Xers. We got the worst of it because we didn't get to benefit from like the drinking and the boozing and all of it. It all changed by the time we got into the workplace. But no, it's in all seriousness, I think you're exactly right. And part of that is, I mean, look, you know, I used to work for a publicly traded company. Publicly traded companies have such scrutiny on them by their shareholders as to really what they're spending money on. In a sense now, because of that scrutiny, you're really focusing far more on the bottom line. So yes, I think that's exactly right. We don't have as much in our budget for the kind of relationship building, but ultimately very expensive things. We still do it. We still are able to, but not as much. And really it's people saying, look, I've got to find a solution. What can you do to help me? I think you're 100% right.
And the other type of relationship is more to that individual, and it's not necessarily to the organization. And so, yeah, it has its, I remember when we, I did procurement stuff back in the 90s, and Walmart was our client, and trying to buy someone from Walmart lunch even was impossible because you couldn't do any of this stuff. And now more companies seem to have moved to that type of model.
They have a code of ethics which prohibit them from accepting amounts, you know, over a certain amount of money, a threshold amount. You're exactly right.
So another thing about, I'm just interested in the smaller brokers, because they seem it's education. But let me ask you a question for them, because it seems like one of the challenges for the smaller intermediaries is to break into those pieces of the business, the contract business for like a large shipper, because a lot of times a large shipper, they're hesitant to use a broker they don't know as well. And there's so many smaller brokers. What would you advise for a broker to do to break into that, contract business as opposed to the pure spot? Any thoughts there?
Well, other than joining TIA, of course,
first and foremost. You're allowed to say that. You're allowed to plug it.
Well, look, I think, you know, brokers are not unique in this sense, because whenever anyone's scaling up, whenever anyone started a new business, you really have to do a lot of cold calls, right? You really have to go out there and say, you know, who can I talk to? But what I've talked to a couple of our smaller members, and what has impressed me is that they found a niche. So, for example, one of our members specializes in oversized, over-dimensional freight. That's 99% of his business. And he's small business. It's under 20 million or under 12, I guess. But he got into that because he saw that he could provide a service that was not currently being offered. And so to me, what is smart is, all right, what's the gap here? What have I known because of my experiences, either throughout working for somebody else or what have you? Where does the gap exist? This guy happened to hit it right with, you know, oversized, overdimensional, but that may not always be the case. But there, to me, is study the marketplace. Study where you think you can actually fill that void. And then that's when you can develop, I think, a huge sort of array of relationships because of that.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Let me ask just a question a little bit about what you did before you came to TIA. So you were with the Department of Transportation and prior to that with CSX, a large class one railroad, obviously. So you're used to working within very large organizations, very, very large. So how has that, now you're working with a wide range of different companies and your partners, how has that changed? Is it different working with so many smaller organizations? What's similar? What have you found that's different?
Sure. So I would say I have visibility into a lot more being in a smaller organization because you just don't have the staff, the team to silo off and say, all right, you're responsible for this. Yeah, you are. But I also have to have oversight into it and understand it and appreciate it because our members are going to ask about it. So when I was at CSX, my purview was government affairs. And so with that, I tried to maximize our advocacy and think about employ different tactics to do that. But I didn't necessarily have insights into, okay, so what is the intermodal strategy? Where are we thinking about developing intermodal facilities? Now, I had to know some of it, but I didn't specialize.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
And at DOT, my oversight, my purview was intergovernmental affairs, and then it was congressional affairs. So again, it was really more government facing. Now, I have a great guy who does government affairs, and I trust him, and I know he's going to advocate us to the best of his ability. So I also have to focus on our membership. How do we attract and retain members? As an example, how do we use media and communications in a very strategic way to make sure the message about TIA gets out? So that, I think, is really the difference is I've got to kind of multitask my brain as opposed to being just so zero focused, really focused, honed in on one particular aspect, one function.
Yeah, this is your first time really running a whole organization. Prior to this, you were very specialized.
Right.
Do you miss anything from not being specialized?
Gosh, do I miss anything? Well,
sometimes, I mean, honestly, so I got a PhD and sometimes I miss those days where I had one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, lots of little things, but I could focus on one thing because the thing that I miss the most is, you get spread broader. There's different levels of satisfaction for doing those things, but I miss the focus sometimes.
Yeah, well, I will tell you, I sure did know a lot about railroads. I sure do. And sometimes people want to hear it. So, sometimes people want to hear more about railroads. Sometimes they don't. So, I was an expert in that. So it's hard not to be an expert. But that'll come with time. Here's a great challenge for all of us. We can't get too comfortable, I don't think. If we get too comfortable, we're probably stagnating rather than growing. So to me, this is a tremendous opportunity.
Okay. Well, and last question.
Sure.
So about the pandemic. So it sounds like there are signs of it easing. You've gotten your first dose. I got my first dose on Friday.
Did you?
So halfway there.
Oh, good for you.
And so we've had to operate under a pandemic for a year, about 13 months. And so did you have any silver linings, anything that you learned or that you were forced to do that you think you'll stick going longer term? Any silver linings that you've seen personally or professionally?
Sure. So a couple things kind of stand out to me, which is, and I'll speak professionally for a second. Some of our members, I visited a member of ours who's up in Maryland, and he said that they really had to flip their mix. So they were, say, 60% food industry, meaning, schools and restaurants, 40% grocery stores, and that flipped. So they flipped it. But, it's kind of, that's a lesson for all of us, which is, sometimes we have to diversify where we can and try to be nimble. I think that's one lesson. The second lesson, I think, is also control what you can control. So what I've learned is there's I don't know what's going to happen with Johnson & Johnson, for example. I don't know what's going to happen with, you know, are we going to need a booster shot next year? I don't know. But we can control this, which is I want my team to treat each other with respect. I want us to have integrity. I want us to be transparent. And I want us to work, you know, first and foremost for our members. And we can control that. So, you know, agility, but also controlling what you can control, that to me are the two takeaways. And from the pandemic, one of the things we also learned is, we don't have to be cheeks and seats all the time. We actually can work. And you know, people do need each other. And I do believe we need to be back in the office at some in some form or fashion. But we also don't have to kill ourselves and not see our families. Because, you know, there's got to be a balance between the two. And so that's a silver lining. You can see your family. You can actually, even if you're on the phone, you can hug your son and have him appear on Zoom for a call. It's okay. Everyone's forgivable. You know, they all forgive it. So anyway, I guess that makes me feel kind of optimistic about the future too.
All right. Well, Ann, thank you so much for talking to me. I really enjoyed this.
Chris, thank you so much. I appreciate it. You didn't talk at all about MIT, so we'll have to do that next time.
We'll do that. Well, next time we're together. Next, I'll be at the, I'm presenting at the TAA conference this year, but it's all virtual. Right. But the next one that is there in person, I'll be there.
Well, I'll make sure I listen in. Again, May 11th through the 13th. I had to throw in my plug.
No worries. No worries. All right, everyone, stay tuned for the Truckload Market Update with Dr. Enam Ayoub.
Welcome to the Over-the-Road Truckload Market Update for May 5th, 2021. In today's market update, we will discuss the market changes in the last 2 weeks. Let's start with dry van. Active rates are up 1.5%. Spot rates down 2.5%. Replacement rate is positive 8%. This means the new contract rates are about 8% above the rates being replaced. On the temp control side, active rates are up 0.5%, spot rates down 5%, and replacement rates positive 7%. Intermodal, active rates are up 1%, spot rates down 1%, and replacement rate is positive 3%. Finally, on the flatbed side, active rates are up 0.5%, spot rates up 1%, and replacement rate is positive 14%.
All right, Enam, so it looks like the same trends from the previous 2 weeks are still continuing here, where replacement rates are still positive and active rates are up slightly, but spot rates continue to fall. What do you think's happening?
Yeah, I think that's the general market that we are seeing. The spot rates been dropping since February, late February. And if you take for dry van, we have seen overall, I think, on the active rate side, it's continuing to increase. And through just from the beginning of the year to now, on average, we see about 1% increase on the active rate side.
And so how does this compare? I know it's dangerous to compare to last year, 2020, but how does that compare to last year, the year previously?
Yeah, I think on the it's interesting because last year, obviously, this is, you know, this exactly when the craziness of the pandemic was. Right. But it was also the time when that whole, you know, downward trend of rates turned direction. So, you know, from this time period in 2020, the rates continue to go up. So if we compare to that time period, so almost a year back, we see about 18 to 20% increase from that time period to today for active rates again. Now, if you go 2 years back, which is 2019, March, April time period, active rates actually peaked coming out of the 2018 capacity cycle. So 2019, right. February, like where the active rates peaked on the top end. So if you compare to 2 years back, so the peak of 2018 cycle to today is about an 8% higher. So we are about 8% higher compared to the peak of 2018 for active rates.
That's funny because the rest of 2019 was more or less rate inflation or rate recession. It just dropped, continues through 2019. Interesting. All right. So it seems like, you know, all the supply chains are in a mess. Things are happening, and maybe that's why this peak is sustaining itself a little longer than we expected. But it's going into the agriculture growing season, into summer now. So do you think it's going to stay up for a little while, or what do you think? Is it going to crest soon? What are your thoughts?
I think obviously the spot rates are dropping, but typically we see a jump back up in June time period.
Right.
So that's what, you know, we continue to see is it seems to be that the spot might come back up coming, you know, closer to end of May, June time period, or it will not continue to drop the way we are seeing. So active rates, I'm not seeing active rates dropping. Maybe it'll flatten out as compared to today, but not dropping until maybe the third quarter.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you, Enam. And that concludes this week's Truckload Market Update.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Freight Find. The Freight Find podcast is hosted by Dr. Enam Ayub and myself, Chris Kaplis, and is produced and edited by DATIQ. For more information or to hear previous episodes, please visit our website at DAT.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to The Freight Find wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to give us a review. As always, if you have any feedback or questions about what you've heard on The Freight Find or suggestions for what you'd like to hear in the future, send an email to me at chris.kaplis@DAT.com. Finally, from all of us at The Freight Find, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new.